Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Question by Stanley Ellen. I am an electrocutioner. I prefer this word to executioner. I think words make a difference. When I was a boy, people who buried the dead were undertakers, and then somewhere along the way, they became morticians and are better off for it. Take the one who used to be the undertaker in my town. He was a decent, respectable man, very friendly if you let him be, but hardly anybody would let him be. Today, his son, who now runs the business, is not an undertaker but a mortician and is welcome everywhere. As a matter of fact, he's an officer in my lodge and is one of the most popular members we have. And all it took to do that was changing one word to another. The job's the same, but the word is different. And people somehow will always go by words rather than meanings. So, as I said, I am an electrocutioner, which is the proper professional word for it in my state, where the electric chair is the means of execution. Not that this is my profession. Actually, it's a sideline, as it is for most of us who perform executions. My real business is running an electrical supply and repair shop, just as my father did before me. When he died, I inherited not only the business from him, but also the position of state's electrocutioner. We established a tradition, my father and I. He was running the shop profitably even before the turn of the century, when electricity was a comparatively new thing, and he was the first man to perform a successful electrocution for the state. It was not the state's first electrocution, however. That one was an experiment and was badly bungled by the engineer who installed a chair in the state prison. My father, who had helped install the chair, was the assistant at the electrocution, and he told me that everything that could go wrong that day did go wrong. The current was eccentric, his boss froze on the switch, and the man in the chair was alive and kicking at the same time he was being burnt to a crisp. The next time my father offered to do the job himself, rewired the chair and handled the switch so well that he was offered a job of official electrocutioner. I followed in his footsteps, which is how tradition is made, but I'm afraid this one ends with me. I have a son, and what I said to him and what he said to me is the crux of the matter. He asked me a question. Well, in my opinion, it was the kind of question that's at the bottom of most of the world's troubles today. There are some sleeping dogs that should be left to lie. There are some questions that should not be asked. To understand all this, I think you have to understand me, and nothing could be easier. I'm 60, just beginning to look my age, a little overweight, suffer sometimes from arthritis when the weather is damp. I'm a good citizen, complain about my taxes but pay them on schedule, wrote for the right party and run my business well enough to make a comfortable living from it. I've been married 35 years and never looked at another woman in all that time. Well, looked maybe, but no more than that. I have a married daughter and a granddaughter, almost a year old, and the prettiest smothingless baby in town. I spoil her and don't apologize for it, because in my opinion, that is what grandfathers were made for, to spoil their grandchildren. Let Mama and Papa attend to the business. Grandpa is there for the fun. And beyond all that, I have a son who asks questions, the kind that shouldn't be asked. Put the picture together, and what you get is someone like yourself. I might be your next-door neighbor. I might be your old friend. I might be the uncle you meet whenever the family gets together at a wedding or a funeral. I'm like you. Naturally, we all look different on the outside, but we can still recognize each other on sight as the same kind of people. Deep down inside, where it matters, we have the same feelings, and we know that without any questions being asked about them. But, you might say, there is a difference between us. You're the one who performs the executions, and I'm the one who reads about them in the papers, and that's a big difference, no matter how you look at it. Is it? Well, look at it without prejudice. Look at it with absolute honesty, and you'll have to admit that you're being unfair. Let's face the facts. We're all in this together. If an old friend of yours happens to serve on a jury that finds a murderer guilty, you don't lock the door against him, do you? More than that, if you get an introduction to the judge who sentences that murderer to the electric chair, you'd be proud of it, wouldn't you? You'd be honored to have him sit at your table, and you'd be quick enough to let the world know about it. And since you're so willing to be friendly with the jury that convicts and the judge that sentences, what about the man who has to pull the switch? He's finished the job you wanted done. He's made the world a better place for it. Why must he go and hide away in a dark corner until the next time he's needed? There's no use denying that nearly everybody feels he should. And there's less use denying that it's a cruel thing for anyone in my position to face. If you don't mind some strong language, it's a damn outrage to hire a man for an unpleasant job and then despise him for it. Sometimes it's hard to abide such righteousness. How do I get along in the face of it? The only way possible. By keeping my secret locked up tight and never being tempted to give it away. I don't like it that way, but I'm no fool about it. The trouble is that I'm naturally easygoing and friendly. I'm the sociable kind. I like people, and I want them to like me. At lodge meetings or in the clubhouse down at the golf course, I'm always the center of the crowd, and I know what would happen if at any such time I ever opened my mouth and let that secret out. A 5-minute sensation, and after that, the slow chill setting in. It would mean the end of my whole life then and there. The kind of life I want to live. And no man in his right mind throws away 60 years of his life for a 5-minute sensation. You can see I've given the matter a lot of thought. More than that, it hasn't been idle thought. I don't pretend to be an educated man, but I'm willing to read books on any subject that interests me. And execution has been one of my main interests ever since I got into the line. I have the books sent to the shop, where nobody takes notice of another piece of mail, and I keep them locked in a bin in my office so that I can read them in private. That's a nasty smell, but having to do it this way. At my age, you hate to feel like a kid hiding himself away to read a dirty magazine, but I have no choice. There isn't a soul on earth outside of the warden at the state prison and a couple of picked guards there who know I'm the one pulling the switch at an execution. And I intend it to remain that way. Oh, yes, my son knows now. Well, he's difficult in some ways, but he's no fool. If I wasn't sure he would keep his mouth shut about what I told him, I wouldn't have told it to him in the first place. Have I learned anything from those books? At least enough to take a pride in what I'm doing for the state and the way I do it. As far back in history as you want to go, there have always been executioners. The day that men first made laws to help keep peace among themselves was the day the first executioner was born. There have always been lawbreakers. There must always be a way of punishing them. It's as simple as that. The trouble is that nowadays, there are too many people who don't want it to be as simple as that. I'm no hypocrite, but I'm not one of those narrow-minded fools who thinks that every time a man comes up with a generous impulse, he's some kind of crackpot. But he can't be mistaken. I put most of the people who are against capital punishment in that class. They are fine, high-minded citizens who've never in their lives been close enough to a murderer or a rapist to smell the evil in them. In fact, they're so fine and high-minded that they can't imagine anyone in the world not being like themselves. In that case, they say anybody who commits murder or rape is just a plain, ordinary human being who's had a bad spell. He's no criminal. They say he's just sick. He doesn't need the electric chair. All he needs is a kindly old doctor to examine his head and straighten out the kinks in his brain. In fact, they say there is no such thing as a criminal at all. They are only well people and sick people, and the ones who deserve all your worry and consideration are the sick ones. If they happen to murder or rape a few of the well ones now and then, well, just run for the doctor. This is the argument from beginning to end, and I'd be the last one to deny that it's built on honesty, charity, and good intentions. But it's a mistaken argument. It omits the one fact that matters. When anyone commits a murder or rape, he is no longer in the human race. A man has a human brain and a God-given soul to control his animal nature. When the animal in him takes control, he's not a human anymore. Then he has to be exterminated. the way any animal must be if it goes wild in the middle of helpless people, and my duty is to be the exterminator. It could be that people just don't understand the meaning of the word duty anymore. I don't want to sound old-fashioned, God forbid, but when I was a boy, things were more straightforward and clear-cut. You learned to tell right from wrong, you learned to do what had to be done, and you didn't ask questions every step of the way. Or if you had to ask any questions, the ones that mattered were how and when. Then along came psychology. Along came the professors, and the main question was always, why? Ask yourself why, about everything you do, and you'll end up doing nothing. Let a couple of generations go along that way, and you'll finally have a breed of people who sit around in trees like monkeys, scratching their heads. Does this sound far-fetched? Well, it isn't. Life is a complicated thing to live. All this life, a man finds himself facing one situation after another, and the way to handle them is to live by the rules. Ask yourself why once too often, and you can find yourself so tangled up that you go under. The show must go on. Why? Women and children first. Why? My country, right or wrong. Why? Never mind your duty. Just keep asking why until it's too late to do anything about it. Around the time I first started going to school, my father gave me a dog, a collie pup named Rex. A few years later, Rex suddenly became unfriendly, the way a dog will sometimes, and then vicious, and then one day he bit my mother when she reached down to pat him. The day after that, I saw my father leaving the house with his hunting rifle under his arm and with Rex on a leash. It wasn't the hunting season, so I knew what was going to happen to Rex, and I knew why. But it's forgivable in a boy to ask things that a man should be smart enough not to ask. Where are you taking Rex? I asked my father. What are you going to do with him? I'm taking him out back of town, my father said. I'm going to shoot him. But why? I said. And that was my father let me see that there is only one question to such a question. Because it has to be done, he said. I never forgot that lesson. It came hard for a while. I hated my father for it. But as I grew up, I came to see how right he was. We both knew why the dog had to be killed. Beyond that, all questions would lead nowhere. Why the dog had become vicious? Why God had put a dog on earth to be killed this way? These are the questions that you can talk out to the end of time. And while you're talking about them, you still have a vicious dog on your hands. It is strange to look back and realize now that when the business of the dog happened, and long before it, and long after it, my father was an electrocutioner. And I never knew it. Nobody knew it, not even my mother. A few times a year, my father would pack his bag and a few tools and go away for a couple of days. But that was all any of us knew. If you asked him where he was going, he would simply say he had a job to do out of town. He was not a man you'd ever suspect of philandering or going off on a solitary drunk, so nobody gave it a second thought. It worked the same way in my case. I found out how well it worked when I finally told my son what I had been doing on those jobs out of town, and I had gotten the warden's permission to take him on as an assistant and train him to handle the chair himself when I retired. I could tell from the way he took it that he was as thunderstruck at this as I had been 30 years before when my father had taken me into his confidence. Electrocutioner? Said my son. An electrocutioner? Well, there's no disgrace in it, I said. And since it's got to be done and somebody has to do it, why not keep it in the family? If you knew anything about it, you'd know it's a profession that's often passed down in a family from generation to generation. What's wrong with a good, sound tradition? If more people believed in tradition, you wouldn't have so many troubles in the world today. It was the kind of argument that would have been more than enough to convince me when I was his age. What I hadn't taken into account was that my son wasn't like me, much as I wanted him to be. He was a grown man in his own right, but a grown man who had never settled down to his responsibilities. I had always kept closing my eyes to that. I had always seen him the way I wanted to, and not the way he was. When he left college after a year, I said, all right. There are some people who aren't made for college. I never went there, so what difference does it make? When he went out with one girl after another and could never make up his mind to marrying any of them, I said, well, he's young. He's sowing his wild oats. The time will come soon enough when he's ready to take care of a home and a family. When he sat daydreaming in the shop Instead of tending to business, I never made a fuss about it. I knew when he put his mind to it, he was as good an electrician as you could ask for. And in these soft times, people are allowed to do a lot more dreaming and a lot less working than they used to. The truth was that the only thing that mattered to me was being his friend. For all his faults, he was a fine-looking boy with a good mind. He wasn't much for mixing with people, but if he wanted to, he could win anyone over. And in the back of my mind, all the while he was growing up, was the thought that he was the only one who would learn my secret someday and would share it with me and make it easier to bear. I'm not secretive by nature. A man like me needs a thought like that to sustain him. So when the time came to tell him, he shook his head and said, no. I felt that my legs had been kicked out from under me. I argued with him, and he still said no, and I lost my temper. Are you against capital punishment? I asked him. You don't have to apologize if you are. I think all the more of you, if that's your only reason. I don't know if it is, he said. Well, you ought to make up your own mind one way or the other, I told him. I'd hate to think that you were like every other hypocrite around who says it's all right to condemn a man to the electric chair and all wrong to pull the switch. Do I have to be the one to pull it, he said. Do you? Somebody has to do it. Somebody always has to do the dirty work for the rest of us. It's not like the Old Testament days when everybody did it for himself. Do you know how they executed a man in those days? They laid him on the ground, tied hand and foot, and everybody around had to heave rocks on him until he was crushed to death. They didn't invite anybody to stand around and watch. You wouldn't have had much choice then, would you? I don't know, he said. And then because he was as smart as they come, and you had to turn your words against you, he said, after all, I'm not without sin. Don't talk like a child, I said. You're without the sin of murder on you, or any kind of sin that calls for execution. And if you're so sure the Bible has all the answers, you might remember that you're supposed to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Well, he said, in that case, I'll let you do the rendering. I knew then and there, from the way he said it and the way he looked at me, that it was no use trying to argue with him. The worst of it was knowing that we had somehow moved far apart from each other and would never really be close again. I should have had enough sense to let it go at that. I should have just told him to forget the whole thing and keep his mouth shut about it. Maybe, if I had ever considered the possibility of his saying no, I would have done it. But because I hadn't considered any such possibility, I was caught off balance. I was too much upset to think straight. I will admit it now. It was my own fault that I made an issue of things and led him to ask the one question he should never have asked. I see, I told him. It's the same old story, isn't it? Let somebody else do it. But if they pull your number out of a hat and you have to serve on a jury and send the man to the chair, that's all right with you. At least it's all right as long as there's somebody else to do the job that you and the judge and every decent citizen wants done. Let's face the facts, boy. You don't have the guts. I'd hate to think of you even walking by the death house. The shop is where you belong. You can be nice and cozy there, wiring up fixtures and ringing the cash register. I can handle my duties without your help. It hurt me to say it. I never talked like that to him before, and it hurt. The strange thing was he didn't seem angry about it. He only looked at me puzzled. Is that all it is to you, he said, a duty? Yes. But you get paid for it, don't you? I get paid little enough for it. He kept looking at me that way. Only a duty, he said, and never took his eyes off me. But you enjoy it, don't you? That was the question he asked. You enjoy it, don't you? You stand there looking through a peephole in the wall at the chair. In 30 years, I have stood there more than 100 times looking at the chair. The guards bring somebody in. Usually he's in a daze. Sometimes he screams, throws himself around and fights. Sometimes it's a woman, and a woman can be as hard to handle as a man when she is led to the chair. Sooner or later, whoever it is strapped down and the black hood is dropped over his head, now your hand is on the switch, the warden signals, and you pull the switch. The current hits the body like a tremendous rush of air, suddenly filling it. The body leaps out of the chair with only the straps holding it back. The head jerks, and a curl of smoke comes from it. You release the switch, and the body falls back again. You do it once more, do it a third time to make sure, And whenever your hand presses a switch, you can see in your mind what the current is doing to that body and what the face under the hood must look like. Enjoy it? That was a question my son asked me. That was what he said to me, as if I didn't have the same feelings deep down in me that we all have. Enjoy it? But my God, how could anyone not enjoy it? The Refugee by Jane Rice. The trouble with the war, Millie Cushman thought, as she stared sulkily through streaming French windows into her rain-drenched garden, was that it was so frightfully boring. There weren't any men anymore. Interesting ones, that is. Or parties, or little pink cocktails, or Café Royale, or long-stem roses wrapped in crackly green wax paper. There wasn't even a decent hairdresser left. She had been a fool to stay on, but it had seemed so exciting. Everyone listening to the radio broadcasts, the streets blossoming with uniforms, an air of feverish gaiety, heady as Moselle wine, over all the city, the conversations that made one feel so important, so in the thick of things. Would the Maginot Line hold? Would the British come? Would the Low Countries be invaded? Was it true America had issued an ultimatum? Subjects that now were outdated as Gatling guns. It had been terrifically stimulating being asked for her opinion as an American, of course. She hadn't come home for a number of years and considered herself a true cosmopolite, freed from the provincialities of her own country. But still, it had been nice in those first flurried jack-in-the-box days of the war to be able to discourse so intelligently on Americana. It had been such fun. Momentarily, Millie's eyes sparkled, remembering. The sparkle faded and died. Then unexpectedly, the city had become a gaunt, gray ghost. No, not a ghost. A cat. A gaunt, gray cat with its bones showing through it as it crouched on silent haunches and stared unwinkingly before it, like one of those cats that hung around the alley barrels of the better hotels, or used to hang. Cooked, the cat bore a striking resemblance to a rabbit. Overnight, a hush had fallen on everything. It was as though the city had gasped in one long, last, labored, dying breath, and had held it. One could feel it in the atmosphere, almost like a desperate pounding. For some inexplicable reason, it reminded her of her childhood, when she had played a game as the street lights began to bloom in the gathering dusk. If I can hold my eyes open without blinking, she would tell herself, until the last one is lighted, I'll get a new doll, or a new muff, or a new hair ribbon, or whatever it might be she wanted. She could still recall that exhausted sense of time running out as the final lights went on. Most always she had won. Sometimes she hadn't, but most always she had, by the skin of her teeth. It would be perfectly horrid if this was one of the times when she didn't win. If she had to stay on and on, trotting back and forth, seeing about that idiotic visa and saving her hairpins and soap ends and things, it wasn't going to be too utterly stultifying. It was fortunate that she had the perception to realize before it was too late who were the right people to know. It helped, although in these days, the right people didn't fare much better than the wrong ones. Millie used fair in its strictest interpretation. Often of late, she found herself dwelling with an aching nostalgia on her father's butcher shop in Pittsburgh. That had been before he invented a new debonair or meat cleaver or something and had amassed an unbelievable amount of money before he strangled to death on a loose gold filling at Tim O'Toole's clam bake. Millie's recollection of her father was but a dim blur of red face and handlebar mustache and a deep booming voice that Millie had associated with a line, "The curfew tolls the knell of parting day," which she had been forced to learn and recite at public school, 46. Her mother, she didn't remember at all, as she had been called to pastures greener than anything Pittsburgh had to offer, while Millie was yet wearing swaddling cloths in a perpetual state of dampness. However, sharpened by adversity, Millie's recollection of the butcher shop were crystal clear. The refrigerator, with whole sides of beef hanging from hooks, legs of lamb like fat tallow candles, plump chickens with thick drumsticks and their heads wrapped in brown paper, slabs of pork and veal, and at Thanksgiving and Christmas, short-legged ducks and high-breasted turkeys, and a big yellow geese. In the showcase had been chops and steaks and huge roasts, and all sorts of sausages and spiced meats laid out in white enamel trays with carrot tops in between for dressing. It was hopeless to dream of these things, but practically impossible to stop. The main topics of conversation no longer were of major developments, but of where one could buy an extra ration of tea of questionable ingredients or a grisly chop of dubious origin or a few eggs of doubtful age, if one could pay the whopping price. Well, as long as she had liquor-filled chocolates and she had had enough foresight to lay in quite a supply, she could be assured of her share. They were better than money at the present exchange. The clock on the mantelpiece tinkled out the hours, and Millie sighed. She should bathe and dress for dinner. But what was the use of keeping up appearances when there wasn't anyone to see? And it was dreadful curling the ends of one's hair on an iron. It was tedious, and it didn't really do a great deal for one. And it had an unmistakable scent of burning shoe leather about it. The water would be tepid, if not actually cold. The soap wouldn't lather. The bathroom would be clammy. And the dinner, when it was forthcoming, would be a rag out of God knew what, a potato that had gouged out areas in it, a limp salad, and a compote of dried fruit. And Maria grumbled so about serving it in courses. It was positively useless to diagram for her the jumbled up indecencies of a table d'hôte. Maria was almost worse than no help at all. Definitely a bourgeois. Millie yawned and stretched her arms above her head. She rose and, going over to the window, stood looking out. A shaft of sunlight broke through the clouds and angered the tiny charms that dangled from her war bracelet. An airplane studded with rhinestones, a miniature cannon with gold leaf wheels, a toy soldier whose diamond chip eyes winked red and blue and green in the sun as he twirled helplessly on his silver chain. 10 or 12 of these baubles hung from the bracelet, and it's indicative of Millie's character that she had bought them as a gift to herself to celebrate the last Bastille Day. The sun's watery radiance turned the slackening rain into shining strings of quicksilver and made a drowned seascape of the garden. The fawn that once had been a fountain gleamed wetly in the pale, unearthly light, and about its feet in the cracked basin, the pelting raindrops danced and bubbled like antiphonic memories of long-gone grace notes. The flower heads were heavy with sodden, brown-edged petals, and their stalks bent wearily, as if cognizant of the fact that their lives were held by a tenuous thread that was soon to be snapped between the chill, biting teeth of an early frost. Millie looked at the rain intermingled with sun and thought, "The devil is beating his wife." That was what Savannah used to say back in Pittsburgh. "The devil's beating his wife, sure enough." Savannah, who made such luscious mince pies and cherry tarts, and whose baked hams were always brown and crunchy on top, and stuck with cloves and crisscrossed with a knife, so that the juice ran down in between the cracks, and Millie's culinary recollection suffered a complete collapse, and her eyes opened very wide as they alighted on a head poking out inquisitively from the leafy seclusion of the tall hedge that bounded the garden. Two brown hands pushed aside the foliage to allow a pair of broad, brown shoulders to come through. Millie gave an infinitesimal gasp. A man was in her garden. A man who, judging from the visible portion of his excellent anatomy, had literally lost his shirt. Instinctively, she opened her mouth to make some sort of an outcry. Whether she meant to call for aid, or to scare the interloper away, or merely to give vent to a belated exclamation of surprise, will forever be debatable, for the object of her scrutiny chose that moment to turn his extraordinarily well-shaped head, and his glance fixed itself on Millie. Millie's outcry died a warning. To begin with, it wasn't a man. It was a youth. And to end with, there was something about him, some queer, indefinable quality that was absolutely fascinating. He was, Millie thought, rather like a young panther or a half-awakened leopard. He was, Millie admitted, entranced, beautiful, perfectly beautiful, as an animal is beautiful. And automatically she raised her chin so that the most unnoticeable pouch under it became one with the line of her throat. The youth was unabashed. If the discovery of his presence in a private garden left him in a difficult position, he effectively concealed his embarrassment. He regarded Millie steadfastly and unwaveringly and admiringly, and Millie, like a mesmerized bird, watched the rippling play of his muscles beneath his skin as he shoved the hedge apart, still further to obtain a better view of his erstwhile hostess. Confusedly, Millie thought that it was lucky the windows were locked, and in the same mental breath, what a pity that they were. The two peered at one another. Millie knew only that his hair was pasted flat to his head with the rain, that his arms shone like sepia satin, and his eyes were tawny and filled with a flickering inward fire that made sweat puddings of her knees. For a long moment, they remained so, their eyes locked, Millie's like those of an amazed china doll, his like those of an untamed animal that was slightly underfed and resented the resulting gastric disturbances. The kitchen door banged, and Millie could hear Maria calling a neighborly greeting to someone as she emptied a bucket of water in the yard. At that instant, the last vestiges of sun began to sink behind the horizon, and the youth was gone. There was just the garden and the rain and the hedge. Dimly, as through a fog, Millie heard Maria come in, heard the latch shoot home, the metallic clatter of the bucket as she set it down under the sink, and from somewhere outside, the long, diminishingly mournful howl of a dog. Millie shook herself out of her trance. She brushed a hand across her eyelids as if to clear them of cobwebs, and unbolting one of the windows, went out into the garden. There was no one, only a footprint by the hedge, a bare footprint filling in with water. She went back into the house. Maria was there, turning on the lamps. She looked at Millie curiously, and Millie realized she must be an odd sight. Indeed, her hair liberally besprinkled with raindrops, her shoes muddy, her dress streaked with moisture. "I thought I saw someone out there just now," she explained. "Someone looking in." "The police, probably," Maria said dourly. "The police have no notion of privacy." "No," Millie said. "No, it wasn't the police. Didn't I hear you go out a few moments ago?" "I wasn't looking in," Maria said in a peevish voice. "For why should I look in? I have other things to do besides looking in the windows." She drew herself up to list vocally and with accompanying gestures the numberless things she had to do. "Did you see anyone?" Millie asked quickly. "Old Philippe," Maria answered. "I saw old Philippe on his way to the inn in the pouring rain, and he with a cough since last April. When one has a cough and it is raining, one does not look in windows. Anyway, Philippe is too old. When one is as old as Philippe, one is no longer interested. Anyhow, his son was killed at Avignon. Philippe would not look in the windows." "You saw no one else?" Maria's eyes narrowed. "Madame was expecting someone, no?" "No," Millie said. "No, I just thought it was nothing. If Madame is expecting someone, perhaps it would be well to save the beverage for later in the evening." "I am expecting no one." "It was," Millie thought, as she let the curling iron rest in the gaseous flame, next to impossible to tell which side of the fence Maria was on. She could easily be reporting things to both sides. One had to be careful, so very careful. "This chap in the garden, for example, he must have escaped from somewhere. That would account for the absence of clothes. He was a refugee of some sort, and refugees of any sort were dangerous. It was best to stick to the beaten path and those who trod thereon. But he was so beautiful, like a stripling god. No more than 20, surely. It was delightful to see again someone as young as 20. It was," Millie swore fluently as the iron began to smoke. She waved it in the air to cool it, and testing it gingerly with a moistened forefinger, applied it to her coiffure. "It was not only delightful, it was heavenly. It was really rather like one of those little long-ago pink cocktails. It did something for one." A faint aroma of singeing hair made itself manifest in the damp, while papery smelling room. Millie considered the refugee from every angle as she ate her solitary dinner, and afterward, as she reclined on her chaise lounge, idly turning the pages of a book selected at random, and while she was disrobing for bed, and even when she was giving the under part of her chin the regulation number of backhanded slaps, a ritual that as a rule occupied her entire attention. Slipping into her dressing gown, she opened her window and leaned out, chin in hands, elbows on the sill. The moon rode in the sky, a hunted thing, dodging behind wisps of tattered cloud, and the air was heavy and wet and redolent of dying leaves. The moon was a ghostly galleon. Millie quoted, feeling somehow frail and immensely poetic. She smiled a sad, fragile smile, in keeping with her mood, and wondered if the refugee also was having a lonely rendezvous with the moon, lying on his back in some hidden spot thinking possibly of her. Her reverie was broken sharply by Maria's voice, shattering the stillness of the night. It was followed by a cascade of water. "What on earth are you doing?" Millie called down exasperatedly. "There was an animal out here," Maria yelled back equally as exasperated, "trampling in my mulch pile." Millie started to say, "Don't be ridiculous, go to bed." But the sentence froze on her lips as she remembered the refugee. He had come back. Maria had thrown water on him. He had returned full of, well, hope for refuge maybe, and Maria the adult had chased him away. "Wait," she called presently into the darkness. "Wait, oh please wait." Maria, thinking the command was for her, had waited, although the please had astonished her somewhat. Muttering under her breath, she had led her strangely overwrought mistress into the kitchen garden and had pointed out with pardonable pride the footprints in her mulch pile, padded footprints with claws. "I saw the eyes," she said, "great, gleaming yellow ones, shining in the light when I started to pull the scullery blinds. Luckily, I had a pot of water handy, and I jerked open the door and..." But her mistress wasn't listening. In truth, for one originally so upset, she had regained her composure with remarkable rapidity. "Undoubtedly, the Trudeau's dog," she said, with a total lack of interest. "The Trudeau's dog is a Pomeranian," Maria said determinedly. "No matter," Millie said. "Go to bed, Maria." Maria went, mumbling to herself a curious litany in which the word Pomeranian was ever and anon distinguishable, and pronounced with expletive force. Millie awakened to find her room bright with sun, which was regrettable as it drew attention to the pattern of the rug and the well-worn condition of the curtains. It likewise did various things to Millie Cushman's face, which were little short of libelous. Libelous, that is, after Millie had painted herself a new one with painstaking care and the touch of an inspired if jaded master. Downstairs, she found her breakfast ready, and because of its readiness, a trifle cold. She also found Maria, while not openly weeping, puffy as to eyes and pink as to nose, and quite snuffly, a state that Millie found deplorable in servants. A series of sharp questions brought to light the fact that old Philippe was dead. Old Philippe, it seemed, was not only dead, but a bit mangled. To make a long story short, old Philippe had been discovered in a condition that bordered on the skeletal. Identification had been made through particles of clothing and a pair of broken spectacles. "You mean to say he was eaten?" Millie cried, which caused Maria to go off into a paroxysm of near hysterics, from which Millie gathered obscurely that Maria blamed herself for old Philippe's untimely demise. By degrees, Millie drew it out of her. The footprints in the mulch pie, the kettle of water, the withdrawal of the animal to more congenial surroundings. Surroundings, doubtless, that were adjacent to the inn from whence old Philippe subsequently plodded homeward. The stealthy pad of marauding feet. The encounter, the shriek, the awful ensuing silence. Maria's detail was so graphic that it made Millie slightly ill, although it didn't prevent her from being firm about the matter of the wolf. "Nonsense," Millie said. "Ridiculous. A wolf? Preposterous." Maria explained about the bloody footprints leading away from the scene of slaughter. Footprints much too large for a dog. Enormous footprints. "No doubt it was an enormous dog," Millie said coldly. "The natural habitat of a wolf is a forest, not a paved street." Maria opened her mouth to go even further into detail, but Millie effectively shut it for her by a reprimand that, like the porridge of the smallest of the three bears, was neither too hot nor too cold, but just right. After all, Millie thought, Philippe was better off. In all probability, he hadn't suffered a great deal. Most likely, he had died of shock first. One more, one less. What difference did it make? Especially when one was as old as old Philippe. At least he had lived his life, while she, with so much life yet to be lived, was embalmed in a wretched sort of flypaper existence that adhered to every inch of her no matter how hard she pulled. That visa. She would have to see about it again tomorrow. And the tea supply was disastrously low, as horrible toast made of horrible bread that was crumbly and dry and tasted of sawdust, and her last bottle of eau de cologne practically gone. And she couldn't eat this mess in front of her. Millie got up and went into the parlor. She flung wide the French windows and petulantly surveyed the garden. She had rented the place because of the garden. Such a lovely setting for informal teas, she had thought. An impromptu chafing dish suppers on the flagstones with candlelight and thin, graceful stemmed glasses. She had pictured herself in appropriate attire, cutting flowers and doing whatever it was one did with peat moss. And now look at the thing. Just look at it. Millie looked at it. Her breath went out of her. She drew it in again with an unbecoming wheeze. One hand flew to her throat. In the garden, fast asleep, curled up in a ball under the hedge, was the refugee, all dappled with shadows and naked as the day he was born. This time, it must be noted, in all fairness, Millie didn't open her chops. If an outcry was in her, it wasn't strong enough to register on her reflexes. Her eyes blinked rapidly, as they always did when Millie was thinking fast. And when she recrossed the parlor and walked down the hallway into the kitchen, her heels made hard staccato sounds in the flooring, as they always did when Millie had reached a decision. Millie's decision made Maria as happy as could be under the circumstances. And 10 minutes later, reticule in hand, Maria departed for the domicile of her married niece's husband's aunt, who was a friend of old Philippe's widow, and consequently would be in possession of all the particulars. It would be more than appreciate a helping hand and an attentive ear over the weekend. Millie turned the key behind her. Lightly, she ran to the scullery closet and took down from a nail a pair of grass-stained pants that belonged to a gardener who had been liquidated before he had a chance to return for his garment. Carrying the trousers over her arm, she retraced her steps to the parlor and through the double French windows. Quiet as she was, her unbidden guest was awake as soon as her foot touched the first flagstone. He didn't move a muscle. He just opened his eyes and watched her with the easy assurance of one who knows he can leave whenever he wants to and several jumps ahead of the nearest competitor. Millie stopped. She held out the pants. "For you," she said. She gave them a toss. The boy, his queer light eyes watching her every movement, made no attempt to catch them. "Put them on," Millie said. She hesitated. "Please," she said, adding, "I am your friend." The boy sat up. Millie hastily turned her back. "Tell me when you get them on," she ordered. She waited and waited and waited, and hearing not the faintest rustle, cautiously swiveled her head around. Once again, she drew in her breath, and the wheeze was very nearly an eek, for not 6 inches away was her visitor. His lips pulled over his teeth in a rather disconcerting smile, his eyes like glittering nuggets of amber. The thought raced through Millie's head that he was going to spring at her, a thought tinged with relief, as she subconsciously noted that he had donned the ex-gardener's pants, tinged too with a thrilling sense of her own charms as the boy's eyes enumerated them one by one. She promptly elevated her chin, tried to keep her consternation from becoming obvious. The boy laughed softly, a laugh that somehow was like a musical sort of a snarl. He stepped back. He bowed mockingly. "What are you doing in my garden?" Millie asked, thinking it best to put him in his place. First and foremost, it wouldn't do to let him out of hand so soon anyway. "Sleeping," the boy said. "Don't you have any place to sleep?" "Yes, many places, but I like this place." "What happened to your clothes?" The boy shrugged. He didn't answer. "Are you a refugee?" "In a way, I suppose, yes." "You're hiding, aren't you?" "Until you came out, I was simply sleeping. After I have eaten, I sleep until a short while before sundown." "You're not hungry?" Millie elevated her eyebrows in surprise. "Not now." The boy let his glance roll fleetingly over his hostess's neck. "I will be later." "What do you mean, until a short while before sundown? Have you been traveling by night?" "Yes." Millie made an ineffectual motion towards the trousers. "Wasn't it, I mean, going around without any, that is, I should think, weren't you cold?" "No." "It's a wonder you didn't catch pneumonia." The boy grinned. He patted his flat stomach. "Not pneumonia," he said. "But it wasn't much better, old and stringy and without flavor." Millie regarded him with a puzzled frown. She didn't like being taken in. She decided to let it go. "My name is Millie Cushman," she said. "You are more than welcome to stay here until you are arrested. You won't be bothered. I have sent my maid away." "You're most kind," the boy said with exaggerated politeness. "Until tonight will be sufficient." If he realized that Millie was expecting him to introduce himself, he gave no sign. After a while, she spoke, a shade irritably. No doubt you do have a name. I have lots of names, even Latin ones. Oh, for heaven's sake, what is one? I can't just go about calling you know. You might call me Lupus, the boy said. It's one of the Latin ones. It means wolf. Do they call you the wolf? Yes. How intriguing, but why? The boy smiled at her. I dare say you'll find out, he said. You mean you're one of the ones who, well, like the affair of that German officer last week? That is to say, in a manner of speaking, you're one of those who's still going at it hammer and tongs? Tooth and nail, the boy said. It seems so silly, Millie said. What good does it do? It doesn't scare them. It just makes them angrier. That makes it harder on us. Oh, but it does scare them, the boy said with an ironic lilt to his voice. It scares them to death. At any rate, it helps. He yawned, his tongue curling out like a cat's. Suddenly he was sullen. He glared at Millie with remote hostility. I'm sleepy, he growled. I'm tired of talking. I want to go to sleep. Go away. Come inside, Millie said. You can have Maria's bed. She gave him her most delectable glance, the one that involved the upsweeping and downsweeping of her eyelashes with the slimmest trace of a roguish quirk about the lips. I won't disturb you, she said, and besides, you might be caught if you stay in the garden. There was a man killed last night by some kind of a creature, or so they say, and Maria's sure to spread the news abroad that she threw water at something and the police just might investigate, and it could be very awkward for us both. Won't you come in, please? The boy looked at her in surly silence. Please, Lupus, for me? Once more, he laughed softly, and this time the laugh was definitely a snarl. He reached out and pinched her. For you, I will. It was, Millie thought, not at all a flirtatious pinch. It was the kind of pinch her father used to give chickens to see if they were filled out in the proper places. But Lupus wouldn't sleep in Maria's bed. He curled up on the floor of the parlor, which Millie thought was just as well. It would save making Maria's bed so Maria wouldn't notice anything. While her caller slept, Millie busied herself with pots and pans in the kitchen. It was tedious, but worth it. Tonight, there would be supper on the flagstones with candles and starlight and all the accessories. A chance like this might not come her way for many another moon. She was resolved to make the most of it. As Savannah would have said, she was going to do herself proud. For Lupus, the best was none too good. Not for herself either. She nibbled a sandwich for luncheon, not wanting to spoil her appetite, not waking Lupus for fear of spoiling his. She got out her precious hoard of condiments. She scanned the fine printed directions on boxes. Meticulously, she read the instructive leaflet enclosed in her paper bag of tan barky appearing flour. She took off her bracelet, rolled up her sleeves, and went to work, humming happily to herself, a thing which she hadn't done for months. She scraped, peeled, measured, sifted, chopped, stirred, beat, and folded. Some fairly credible muffins emerged from under her unaccustomed and amateurish fingers, a dessert that wasn't bad at all, and a salad that managed to give the impression of actually being a salad, which bordered on the miraculous. The day slowly drew to a close, and Millie was quite startled to find the hours had passed with such swiftness, so swiftly that her initial awareness of their passing was caused by the advent of a patently ill-humored Lupus. Oh dear, Millie said, I didn't realize. Is it late? No, Lupus said, it's growing early. The sun is going down. Are you hungry? I'm fixing some things I think will be rather good. I'm ravening, Lupus said. Let's go watch the sunset. Millie put her hands up to her coiffure, coquettishly allowing her sleeves to fall away from her round white arms. Wait till I fix my hair. I must be a sight. You are, Lupus agreed, his eyes glistening, and I won't have to wait much longer. Effortlessly, he moved across and stood over Millie, devouring her with an all-encompassing gaze. Won't you have one of these? Millie asked hurriedly, hoping his impetuosity wouldn't brim over too abruptly. She shoved a box of liqueur-filled chocolates at him. There's no such thing as a cocktail anymore. Come along, we'll eat them on the sofa. It's cozier. But Lupus wasn't interested in the chocolates. In the parlor, he stretched his long, supple length on the floor and contemplated the garden, ablaze in the last rays of a dying sun. Millie plopped down beside him and began to rub his back, gently with long, smooth, even strokes. Lupus rolled his head over in a lazy, indifferent pleasure and looked up at her with a hunger that would have been voluptuous if it hadn't been so stark. Do you like that? Millie whispered. For a reply, Lupus opened his mouth and yawned, and into it, Millie dropped the chocolate, while at the same instant, she jabbed him savagely with a hairpin. The boy sucked in his breath with a pained howl, and a full 8 minutes before the sun went down, Lupus had neatly choked to death on a chocolate whose liquor-filled insides contained a silver bullet from Millie Cushman's war bracelet. It had been, Millie told herself, a near thing, and it would have been ghastly if it hadn't worked. But it had worked, tra-la. Of course, it's good to reason that it would. After all, if at death a werewolf changed back into human form, why, logically, the human form would, if in close personal contact with a silver bullet before sundown, metamorphosis into a wolf. It was marvelous that she happened to pick up the werewolf of Paris yesterday and had given her insight, so to speak. It was extremely handy, since she'd had all the butcher shop background. Millie wiped her mouth daintily with a napkin. How divinely full she was. And with Maria gone, she could have Lupus all to herself. Down to the last delicious morsel.